Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Genocide. It's an ugly word, often associated with the attempt by the Nazis to wipe out the Jews in World War II to the tune of 6 million deaths. This is known as the Holocaust. Pol Pot in Cambodia butchered 1.3 to 3 million people between 1975 and 1979. Joseph Stalin of Russia led the Holodomor genocide, killing between 1.8 and 7.5 million Ukrainian people in 1932 and 1933. The early 1930s also was when the Ottoman government went to Kazakh and wiped out between 1.3 and 1.75 million people. There are other incidents of one people group using military and political force to wipe out another people group in recent history. There are several other large-scale genocides just in the last 100 years that have occurred. But there is one genocide that has happened in recent history, and many listening to this episode were alive when it occurred. I'm connected to this specific event, and today's episode will share the horrors of the most recent large-scale genocide in modern history, and my involvement in the aftermath. That event? The Rwandan genocide. It was April 6, 1994, that one of the larger genocide events to occur on this planet was sparked. The date of posting this episode was chosen to be April 6, 2024, exactly 30 years to the day from when the Hutu-Tutsi genocide started. It is estimated that 800,000 to 1 million people were murdered in heinous ways and resulted in a mass migration of 1 million people crossing over into DR Congo, then called Zaire. Countless others were injured, both physically and emotionally, at a level most of us could never imagine or understand. These refugees were allocated to the two main towns on the shore of Lake Kivu in eastern Zaire, which borders Rwanda. These towns were Goma on the north side and Bukavu on the south side. There were 750,000 refugees in three main camps outside of Goma and about 250,000 in Bukavu. It is estimated that 100,000 of these refugees were orphan or unaccompanied children. It was a tragedy rife with political intrigue, inaction on the part of the world and the United Nations, mass butchery, pillaging, and major destruction of one of the more successful countries in Central Africa. The killings lasted for 100 days. To set the stage for the trigger of this mass genocide, I need to give a little history lesson as to Rwanda and the two main tribes that occupied that country with its colonizing country, Belgium. You remember Belgium, right? That's the little European country that colonized the Congo in 1908 and ceded independence in 1960. Well, first Germany in the late 1800s, then Belgium in the early 1900s, colonized Rwanda, eventually ceding independence in 1962. During its occupation, the Belgians favored the Tutsi tribe over the Hutu tribe. In rough numbers, Tutsis were about 15% and Hutus 85% of the population. By playing favorites for government positions, education, opportunities, etc., there was an undercurrent of resentment between the minority groups, the Tutsis, and the majority group, the Hutus. This wedge had been ongoing and festering for generations. During its life as a country, there was ongoing back and forths of government power, numerous wars and battles and rebellions, killing hundreds of thousands of people. Then, after years of Tutsi political control, the power flipped to the Hutus, putting one of their own in the presidency. And on April 6, 1994, the spark was lit that set off the ensuing 3.5 months of butchery that impacted the entire country. What was that event? It was the private plane of the new Hutu president that went down just before landing. Though some say it was a plane crash, others claimed it was shot down. Numerous investigations are certain of a surface-to-air missile being the cause of the crash. I've heard and read about both sides, and my money is on the plane being shot down. Here's why I say that. Certain people had been sending in shipping containers of machetes into Rwanda before this occurred, which leads one to deduce that a rebellion of sorts was being planned well before April 6th to take back political control. The Hutus were preparing for something. Maybe they anticipated something like an assassination attempt to be their excuse to try and wipe out the Tutsis that they hated and had been subservient to by the Belgians and Tutsis alike. And maybe they wanted to rid themselves of their political and war rivals once and for all. Don't know, but regardless, that event of the president's plane going down triggered the biggest act of brutality and butchery in modern times. It also resulted in the largest migration in recent history, 1 million displaced people. The Tutsi Army, known as the Rwanda Patriotic Front, or RPF, got pushed down into Burundi. They only numbered about 5,000. They regrouped, licked their wounds, and then came back to reclaim their position in the country. With this, the Hutu army, numbering about 30,000 soldiers, realized they were going to be in trouble militarily, so went on a spree of destruction of the people, the infrastructure, and the country. They started killing anybody resembling a Tutsi. They burned homes, schools, hospitals, factories, and so on. Any Tutsi, or anybody they thought was a Tutsi, had a target on their back. Hutus would kill their neighbors for being from the other tribe. As an example of the destruction, when I went into Rwanda for a few days on a fact-finding tour in 1994, we toured a hospital that was completely ransacked and destroyed. Hutu soldiers had busted windows, broken fixtures, ripped beds and furniture, torn x-ray machines from the walls, knocked over medicine cabinets, and just looted the entire facility. It was almost surreal when I walked through that empty hospital, sort of like an apocalypse movie. You see, their mindset was that if they were going to be on the losing end of the conflict, then they'd destroy the country on their way out of Dodge. Hutus got on the radio and other media and stirred up the populace, calling for extermination of any Tutsi, calling them cockroaches and other vermin. The mob mentality ensued, and it was ugly. Everyone needs to understand how easily we humans can slip from civility to savagery. Civil society is very fragile. Anarchy is not a distant condition. It's closer to our present than we think. I recall one story I heard where two Hutu brothers were married, one to a Hutu wife and the other to a Tutsi wife. The one married to the Hutu wife told his brother that if he didn't kill his Tutsi wife because of the conflict, then he would. Amazing the power of tribalism and hatred, such that someone was going to kill his sister-in-law because of her tribal roots. Totally sick. There are other incredible stories of inhumanity and savagery where Hutu soldiers mowed down parents with machine guns and machetes right in front of their kids. I also remember talking to a man who shared that 29 members of his family had been killed. Brothers, sisters, parents, aunts and uncles, and cousins. Unbelievable. How do you move forward after having your family wiped out? There are other acts of butchery and barbaric acts that I won't share here that will make you ill just hearing them, since I want to keep this podcast at a PG level and family friendly. You're better off not hearing some of the stories I heard during my time there. Trust me. Sadly, the United Nations and many, quote, humanitarian, unquote, countries stood by while this genocide was occurring. And it was very late in the process before NGOs, that's the acronym for non-government organizations, which are humanitarian / relief groups, got involved with helping deal with the crisis in Rwanda and then in Zaire with the refugee camps. The people crashed through the border into Goma at the north end of Lake Kivu and into Bukavu at the south end. After taking over Goma, a town of about 100,000, the infrastructure couldn't handle it, obviously. So the people got moved into three camps of 250,000 people per camp. An interesting thing I noticed was that in town, all the trees were skinny from the ground to about 8 or 9 feet up. What had happened is that the refugees needed firewood, so they'd hack the trunks of all the trees to get the wood, reaching up to about 9 feet with their machetes. Above 9 feet, the tree trunks were normal thickness. Needless to say, green firewood doesn't burn very well, and that action only damages the tree. Many trees were dying or dead when I got there in September due to this firewood-seeking carnage. In July, the refugee camps were overflowing and not enough aid had come in, and people were dying like crazy. I saw a line graph chart at the UN office in Goma in September during my time there that 20,000 per week were dying in July as cholera was running rampant due to the lack of proper latrines and good water and food. By September, that number was down to 1,000 per week. The UN felt that was, quote, acceptable, unquote. Not sure I agree, but with 1 million people living in squalor under tarps, maybe that is expected. Thelma Landrud, a now-retired nurse from Zaire in Congo, went to Goma in August 1994 to work in the refugee camps. She endured extremely difficult living and working conditions. The killings had ended, and the refugee camps were in total chaos, and there was minimal order. Thelma led a team with the following responsibilities.
Well, the first responsibility was getting our team there, and we were the ones that started the whole thing. So it was setting things up from scratch. And I marvel sometimes at how you get involved in doing something like this. And it turned out to be a wonderful experience, but we certainly depended on the Lord and a lot of people helping get us ready to go. We didn't know what we needed to bring.
Due to poor water supplies and poor latrine situations, cholera and dysentery was running rampant in July. Thousands were dying each week, as mentioned, and were buried in mass graves.
By the time we got there, the cholera epidemic was on the wane. We saw bodies laid out on the street that were being picked up by trucks every morning when we went to work. But I did not see any of the graves. I heard about them, but I did not see them myself. It wasn't something that you wanted to go and see just to say that you had seen it. There were less and less, as the weeks went by, there were less and less people dying. So you knew it was getting under control.
When the craziness and killing was going on in Rwanda and the general populace was fleeing, it was not orderly. It was sheer panic and chaos, often at night. People ran, were carried, and so on to flee the killing, machetes, and guns. I had one child tell a story of being carried on a man's shoulders as she was injured. Her name was Becca. She made it to Goma and was put under our care. She had no clue about her parents or relatives. She was only 3 or 4. So with that, how does one deal with trying to connect kids and parents when there are 750,000 people living in tents? By the way, I've added the transcript of her story on my website. You should check it out. There were an estimated 100,000 orphan or unaccompanied children in total. If an unaccompanied 6-year-old child can tell people their name, their village, and names of relatives, that increased the chance of matching them with their family members at some point. But what about a little 2-year-old that was carried across the border? They don't know their name or village or family. So how, in that mass of people, would they ever be reunited? Very sad situation that broke my heart.
That was set up by the Red Cross, and everybody who was working with kids got the armbands and was told how to go about doing it. I don't remember the pictures and the albums. I think that came after me. We were still in the process of getting names for kids and at least documenting who we had in our camp. We set up like a tent city, and it was mostly widows or moms who were missing their own children who were taking care of maybe 8 or 10 kids in a tent. And so they were trying to make it sort of like a family, and a mom was in charge of those kids. And then we set up a health center or a small dispensary where we could take care of the health needs of our group. Getting their names and figuring out where they were from, it was interesting that they would often use churches as a reference point because that was what kids would remember. We had no idea, as far as the country was concerned, where they were from. Somebody said, well, how can these kids get lost? And when you realize that estimated 800,000 people crossed that border, which is like a one-lane road between Rwanda and Goma. And a big truck would come through, and they just blow their horn, and everybody has to get out of the way. So the families would be split up, and then everybody would get back on the road, and the kids would never see their parents again, and they were just lost. And that was the big problem in having so many children that were unaccompanied.
Even for a seasoned nurse that had served in Central Africa for many years, the overwhelming nature of this situation did impact her.
I had never been involved in a situation like that other than such a big event and how the world comes together to help in that kind of a situation with the NGOs. And in the beginning, it was chaos because nobody was in charge. But then once they got UNHCR there, they sort of made some progress in getting groups working together and figuring out who could help in what area so they weren't all doubling up on what they were doing.
Yet, in spite of all the challenges and sorrow and sickness and death, there were rays of sunshine and joy that she experienced.
We had hired a few people to work with us in the camp, and I don't remember what the gal's job was, but she lived in town and she went back with us. And she came to work one day and she says, "I've heard that my two daughters have been found." And so we said we would try to help her find them. So on our way home from work, she had been told an area of the town of Goma where she should be looking for her girls. And so we drove down the street and actually we heard her say, "There they are." And yet when she actually got out of the car and saw the kids, it was like there was no emotion shown. And it was like either she didn't really believe that they were really her girls, or there was so much trauma that she didn't really know how to react to the fact that she had actually found her daughters. But they were her two daughters that she found, and we saw them reunited, which was really special.
I was watching this event on the news and reading about it in the newspaper to stay current, as it directly impacted Zaire, which is where I grew up. It was one day in late July 1994 that I was reading the newspaper at breakfast and started crying in my Cheerios when the article shared about an aid worker witnessing someone with cholera falling over on her bike and dying right in front of her. That's when I decided to do something about it. I started calling relief organizations and sending letters to volunteer my services. I'd grown up in Zaire, so was fluent in French and Lingala, the local trade language that is spoken throughout the country. I knew I could be an asset and not a liability. Though not a doctor or nurse, which is what most NGOs were asking for, I still knew I could be of value. I contacted 13 organizations. Most responded with a no, due to not being of a medical background. Then I reached out to my parents' mission board, and they connected me to World Relief, Inc., a group that was loosely affiliated with the Covenant Church and one that we'd worked alongside with in Zaire. A team was being put together of a doctor and a nurse, and they wanted a general logistics guy, so would I go? I said yes. There wasn't a set date, as things were in flux and the situation changed regularly in Goma. Email wasn't really a thing, so communication was by long-distance phone calls and faxing, making it tough to stay current. So in preparation for when I might be called to go, I started getting my shots and meds. I'd walk into a clinic and ask for yellow fever, MMR, hepatitis B, typhoid, polio, tetanus, and gamma globulin shots and a prescription for quinine as a deterrent to malaria. The doctor would look at me strangely until I told him my destination. One doctor actually waived all the costs of my shots. It was touch and go about going, as communication with Goma was challenging for several weeks. Then I got a phone call and had airplane tickets FedExed to me on Wednesday for a Saturday departure. Then, Friday night, the trip got canceled. Then uncanceled a few hours later. Boy, that messed with my psyche. I got a ride to the airport at 0:30 and left my wife and two young children, not knowing if I'd return. I can't remember ever feeling that way before. I flew from L.A. to New York, where I met Dr. Tom Cairns, who I'd known in Zaire since 1970, and Karen Campbell, a nurse from Pennsylvania. Neither Tom nor I had met Karen before. Dr. Tom had brought several boxes of medicine with him, so when we checked in at British Airways, we asked if we could all sit together. We told the ticket agent we were headed to work in the Rwanda refugee camps. She said she'd see what she could do. She didn't charge us for the extra boxes of medicines. Then, upon departure, we walked down the ramp to the plane. It was a 747. The flight attendant looked at our boarding passes and pointed up. Huh? So up the staircase we went to the bubble of the plane. 16 seats only, a dedicated flight attendant, little slippers and toiletry kits, and our own TV screens with headphones, etc. We were flying in style. Remember, this is 1994, and TV and movies on planes were not commonplace like 2024. I didn't sleep the entire flight to London so I could play with all the cool technology and entertainment. At London, we had a long layover, so got hotel rooms. Then we ended up flying to Nairobi, Kenya. There, we got our visas to enter Zaire. I should mention that we went to the Zaire embassy, and by using my Lingala with the staff, we expedited our paperwork and got them that very afternoon. Amazing how language breaks down barriers. Another memory I'd forgotten about until I reread my daily journal of my trip was my attempt to get my jet lag sorted out sooner than later. While waiting for our visas to be processed, everyone else went shopping while the car was parked on the street, Kenyatta Avenue, a major thoroughfare in downtown Nairobi. I stayed in the car with the windows rolled down because it was hot. Then I fell asleep for almost an hour. Here I was, zonked out, sawing logs, probably with my mouth open too, on one of the busiest streets in the city. The next day, we flew in a small six-seat Cessna 206 airplane from Nairobi to Mwanza, Tanzania, at the base of Lake Victoria to refuel and have lunch. Then it was on to Goma, Zaire. Goma Airport. What a bastion of activity. All sorts of planes coming and going, bringing supplies, people and volunteers to deal with the crisis of feeding and caring for 750,000 refugees in the area. There were forklifts hauling pallets of beans, rice, tarps, medical supplies, trucks being loaded, you name it. It was pretty amazing to see. Our NGO, World Relief Inc., had rented a house about 30 feet from Lake Kivu for the volunteers. The yard was surrounded by an 8-foot wall, then there was a road, then the water. There were 10 on our team. Most of the women and girls slept in the house, and I was in a little tent outside on the grass with several other folks in tents. The women used the indoor shower, and the men bathed out of a bucket in the back. We also had two Congolese male nurses that were with us that came from Karawa, where I'd grown up, so that made for some fun and camaraderie. So what were our responsibilities?
My role actually was primarily medical, working in the little clinic at Mubumbiro, where that was one of the three big main camps that had been set up in the Goma area.
That was Dr. Tom Cairns, a medical doctor that served in Congo and Zaire for many years and who I've known since 1970. He's currently retired in the Minneapolis area.
And it was basically a tent clinic, just working there, doing all kinds of medical type things. And then during the course of the time there, they also asked me to go and evaluate two hospitals that were in the area, Ruanguba, which was some 70 miles north, and Kibogoro, which was actually in Rwanda on the shores of Lake Kivu. And asked me to look them over and see what needed to be done to improve care for all these large numbers of patients that had come to Ruanguba and all the destruction and damage that had occurred at Kibogora. And so those were two of the things.
Our NGO, World Relief Inc., was responsible for the oversight and care of 175 unaccompanied or orphan children that were being housed in Zairean's home in a village just outside one of the main camps. Here is a typical day of our team.
We were staying at a house in Goma at that point, And then we would drive out to the camp at Mobile through the large numbers of people on this road, weaving our way through in these vans that we were provided. And upon arrival, we'd kind of divide up and do different things. My primary role then was in the medical tent. You have to understand, this was a time when massive numbers of people were there. They had been there for weeks already, and they had no sanitation facilities. Just trying to dig a hole for a latrine in lava is all but impossible. And so some of the other agencies, like the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, had brought in some machines and were setting up some temporary type latrines. But that didn't change the fact that there was contamination, stool, all kinds of debris and detritus everywhere, and flies flying around all over. And the result was dysentery and specifically cholera. And we had a great deal of that going on. As a result, people were coming into the medical tent very dehydrated, seriously ill. And so we were doing what we could with limited supplies of IVs, trying to get them rehydrated. That was a major part of it. Then there were large numbers of children. At that time, we didn't like to use the word orphans, so we were saying unattached children, because they'd been separated from their parents, and they didn't know where their parents would be, but they were themselves needing nutrition and needing help of all sorts. So that would be a typical day, and we'd be there for 8 hours or whatever. And much of the time was spent that way.
Though experienced, having served in a hospital for many years in Congo, Tom reflects on the Rwanda refugee camp conditions.
I had worked for 19 years at that point previously in Congo, which I thought was significant poverty. But nothing like that can be what we saw there in the Goma or in the camps. Extreme poverty, people who had nothing to work with, and they would come in with illnesses that we normally wouldn't even see in Congo just because of infections and so forth.
After his return and further reflection of the whole experience, here are a few thoughts he shares.
It's hard to say one memory. You know, the massive amount of humanity and the huge numbers of people, the primitive shelters that they were climbing into, just sticks and supporting huge tarps, blue tarps of not much bigger than an animal would crawl into, literally, maybe 10, 12 feet long and 4 feet high or something like that. And you have a whole family in there, and the sanitation things. The trips for me to see those two hospitals, I had seen a lot of mission hospitals before. Ruwenguba was still somewhat functional, but overwhelmed. And the other hospital, Kibogora, was a wonderful hospital, one of the best mission hospitals I'd ever seen at that point. And yet it was destroyed. It was horribly, horribly destroyed by all the pillaging and damage that was done in the fighting that had gone on there. And to see those two and realize these both have huge opportunities to serve these people. So some of those kinds of impressions just really stood out to me. Being a hospital doc myself, those two things really stood out as well.
Our schedule was 6 days a week in our part of the camp, doing medical treatment, delivering food, and checking on the 175 kids under our care, as Dr. Tom mentioned. Our area was in Mumbimbiro, about 15 miles outside of Goma, near the third large camp. These kids stayed with foster Zairean families as they were either orphans or unaccompanied children, having been separated during the fleeing from Rwanda. The drive through the camps each day to our designated area was an adventure. We drove this VW van that was a true jalopy. We had to kick the side door to open it and close it. Blue tarps were made into makeshift tents and dotted the hillsides almost as far as one could see. Every tent was where a few people lived and spent the night. The other thing was the smoke. Each tent had a fire going around the clock for cooking. Thus, there was smoke and lots of it, as anything and everything that could be burned was. The sanitation situation was awful. Proper latrine facilities were finally in place when we arrived in September. However, the smell was brutal, as in some areas latrines weren't used, and the zillions of flies made for a most unpleasant environment and air quality. There were teams of people that carried tanks on their backs and sprayed pesticide for flies all over the camps to keep their numbers to a minimum. I don't think bringing the fly population from 1 trillion to 0.5 trillion had much effect, but the UN must have felt it did. Each morning on the drive out, anybody that had died in the night was wrapped in a cloth or blanket and lying on the edge of the road. Daily, a big truck came by to pick up the dead bodies for burial. No service, no fanfare, no memorial. Pretty sad. I noticed more bodies for pickup when it had rained the night before. Interesting. One kid in our care wanted to have me hold him or have his hand held. I later heard his story of being sexually assaulted by another man and being injured with a gash on his leg and his head. Every day I was there, he was by my side, holding my hand, or I would be carrying him. Besides doing whatever needed doing with the myriad projects and duties and helping everyone, I was asked to draw a map of the village where our 175 kids were staying. We didn't know which kids were staying with which family and where to find them in the village. Mind you, they don't have street names or house numbers, or hut numbers, as it were, so it was a daunting task. I picked our normal meeting area where we did our food distribution and medical checkups as ground zero and then worked out from there. With a notepad in hand, I did my best to determine distances and directions and marked the huts on my map. I paced off as best as I could, always trying to keep the main road and ground zero in perspective. So I spent several days walking around with paper in hand, marking and pacing, and asking folks about where the refugee kids were housed. I'm certain I would have flunked any land surveyor assignment, but I did the best I could. After 3 days, we had a rudimentary map, not to scale, but one that gave a general idea of where the kids we were responsible for were housed with the Zairean families. The emotional and psychological weight and trauma for the volunteers was incredible. The sheer numbers of people, the conditions, the poverty, the sadness, the lack of hope, and death was a tremendous weight on everyone. So much so that most NGOs, ours included, had a policy that after 3 weeks of working, you had to rotate out for a week to Tanzania, Kenya, or somewhere else to get away and clear your head and restore your mental strength. Go on a safari, go to the beach, read a book by the pool, anything to change what was in your mind. Too much of this crisis environment would cause long-term mental and emotional issues. There was never a dull moment. Gunshots in the night were commonplace, even in town where we were. One time, our group was driving two vehicles loaded with supplies through the camps. There was some separation between our vehicles when all of a sudden a Hutu soldier started shooting at people. He was between our vehicles. I was in the front truck and we kept going on to Goma. The UN headquarters started sending out the news on the radio to everyone to hunker down due to the danger and shooting in the Mugunga camp. The other truck turned around and found safety in a World Vision compound in the middle of one of the camps. They spent the night there, and while we tried to confirm they were safe with our radios, we didn't hear until the next day that they were okay. It is important to note that there was considerable resentment and cultural conflict. For example, in the Zairean culture, one shares with everyone, especially food. So having the UN treat the Rwandan refugees with free food, medical care, water, and other basic living supplies that couldn't be shared with the Zaireans was conflicting. Picture a Zairean family that had taken in several orphan Rwandan kids, and the kids were given their allocation of rice and beans. But that food couldn't be shared with the foster family since they weren't refugees. It didn't seem fair. Or, the Zaire military hadn't been paid, And yet they would watch the Hutu soldiers stealing rice and beans from the UN warehouse and selling it in the camps. That caused resentment and sparked the Zairean military to steal or shake down people for money. Besides shakedowns in the camps, they happened in town too. One day, we were driving in Goma, and a Zairean soldier flagged us down. He started speaking French to one of our volunteers that was driving. He starts giving some story about licenses or registration or something or other. He just wanted some money, so he would leave us alone. After several minutes of back and forth between Phil and the soldier, I piped up from the back seat. Ndi, likamo nini awa? Hey, buddy, what's the deal here? He looked at me. Then I responded, Yeba ete tuzaliba Amerikan pambate, kasi nazali mwana mboka, mwana na Zaire. Tika biso tokenda. Translated, know that we're not just normal Americans. Rather, I'm a son of the village, a child of Zaire. Let us go on our way. Needless to say, he realized he was dealing with a local that spoke the language, so his chances of squeezing some cash out of us probably wasn't going to work. As mentioned, knowing the local language is very advantageous. They estimated about 30,000 Hutu soldiers were in the camps, controlling the million people through fear and threat. Doing the math, since roughly 800,000 to 1 million people had been killed, that meant each soldier killed around 30 people in Rwanda as part of the genocide. Those of you old enough might remember the CNN TV footage of dead bodies floating down the river. Well, here's what really happened. You see, the remaining folks in Rwanda were asking their fellow countrymen and women to return home. Please come back to your homes, factories, jobs, schools, etc. Well, the Hutu soldiers had control of this huge block of people. So how to keep it? Fear. So what they'd do when some folks said they wanted to return home to Rwanda is they'd kill them, take the bodies, and dump them in the river. News would spread, and then they'd tell everyone.
See, you can't trust those folks in Rwanda. Be warned, if you return, they'll kill you and dump your body in the river, just like the others that went back yesterday.
Another reality was the corruption of the United Nations. I could go on a total rant about the UN, but suffice it to say is that most money the U.S. taxpayers contribute doesn't do much good. To wit, our NGO was allocated a certain amount of beans and rice from the UN warehouse to feed our kids. Well, often, they'd not have our food allotment for pickup. Yet, while driving through the camps and the markets that had sprung up along the road, there would be a few Hutu soldiers sitting on huge stacks of beans and rice, selling to all the people in the camps. And if you looked closely, you'd see the words, gift from the U.S. government, printed on the side. What a total crock. Who got paid off for that? So what did we do? Reach into our own pockets to buy rice and beans so the kids in our care could eat. Here's a good one. One night, I'm sleeping in my tent about 10 feet from the perimeter wall adjacent to the road, which was about 30 feet from the edge of Lake Kivu. Around 4 a.m., I wake up to... A few minutes later, another... Apparently, some brilliant fisherman decided to toss some grenades into the lagoon to get his limit of fish. I remember thinking, what if he'd been drunk or something and tossed it over the wall instead? I'd be dead, and you'd not be listening to this podcast. One day, half our team took a boat trip across Lake Kivu. We were asked to assess the needs of a Zairean village that had taken in some refugees and were helping house and feed them. This little village of 200 to 300 people had 1,503 people that they were helping out. Could we send supplies like food, tarps, and medicine? Wow. As mentioned previously, everything about this crisis was overwhelming. And I commend these villagers for opening their homes and wallets to help the refugees in need. 1,503 people, spread out over 200 to 300 families. I had another experience I'll never forget. While the word awesome is overused in our current society, especially by the younger generation, and doesn't carry the weight of the true meaning of the word, there is one thing I experienced that was truly awesome. It was a Sunday afternoon that I was out and about with the male nurses. We were at a house to help fix something, which is maybe 50 yards from the end of the Goma airport. Well, a Russian plane called an Antonov, which is the largest cargo plane in the world, took off. It took off in our direction, meaning that after liftoff, it was maybe 100 feet above us as it was roaring into the sky. This plane was loud and huge. A 747, or Hercules C-130 cargo plane, is dinky compared to this behemoth. The size of this monster, with its powerful jet engines roaring and the whole place shaking and being right under it, was one of the most memorable things I have ever experienced. Remember, countries were bringing in tons and tons of food, vehicles, supplies, and materiel to deal with a million refugees. So the largest cargo plane in the world was doing its part. It was awesome. My trip home was 40 hours long. I was dropped off in the morning at the Goma airport, waiting for a UN charter plane to Nairobi. With my UN ID, that gave me some privileges. I remember sitting at the airport in my jeans and t-shirt after spending several weeks working in Goma. I probably looked rather experienced and maybe even a bit scruffy and rugged to the newbies walking up the ramp from the tarmac. They were taking it all in, the activity, the smells, and their anticipation of what to expect. It was like the scene in the movie Platoon, where Charlie Sheen's character, Chris Taylor, was wide-eyed, fresh, naive, and green when he got to Vietnam. He was in shock and overwhelmed upon his arrival and couldn't handle what he saw initially. Cargo planes, vehicles, body bags, etc. Someone who'd been there for some time yelled,
"Welcome to Vietnam."
That was a great scene in the movie. Well, I sat for 6 hours in Goma waiting for my plane. Some newbie volunteers landed that morning and walked up to the terminal where I was standing. They were taking it all in. The planes, supplies, equipment, and activity. I knew what the new volunteers would be in for, and they were probably wondering what I'd been through as I was waiting to go home. I certainly looked experienced and hardened after my tour of duty and was ready to go home. "Welcome to Goma," I said. I gave them a weak smile with a tinge of a smirk. I caught an Aeroflot UN charter plane with a bunch of German water engineers that had helped with the water supply to take me to Nairobi, Kenya.
They smoked and drank the whole flight.
And yes, the flight attendants were Russian.
I had 7 hours till my flight to London. I started contemplating the previous 3 weeks of my life and what I'd experienced. So I got some paper and a pen, and I wrote the following.
Goma, Zaire, a quiet border town nestled in one of Central Africa's most picturesque settings. The altitude is 5,000 feet with green rolling hills, majestic mountains, and expansive Lake Kivu. Goma, Zaire, a quaint little place where the air is cool and the views so nice. An active volcano rises to the skies, glowing orange at night. Goma, Zaire, in early 1994, unknown to the world. On April 6, 1994, the Rwandan president's plane went down, setting off a stream of civil war, fighting, and murderous butchery. The world stood by and watched. As the Hutus lost to the minority Tutsis, they ran, butchering and plundering over 500,000 civilians. Rwanda was in upheaval. The country was in disarray. And Goma lay quiet, a quiet border town. Countless dead in Rwanda, Over 1 million refugees crashed through the Zaire border to result in one of this decade's worst tragedies. A wave of adults and children, carrying only a few possessions, ran away to safety, to Goma. Others poured into Bukavu, to the south, over a single-lane bridge. A stampede of humanity invaded the quiet border town. Wake up, Goma. You may rest and sleep. No longer. With people came sickness and disease, cholera and dysentery. Food and water were in short supply. People dying, over 20,000 per week, bodies stacked 10 high, with not enough graves and not enough people to move them. Bulldozers dug through the rock, and hundreds were tossed inside, with no ceremony or wake. Nameless bodies in unmarked tombs. Oh, Goma, you healthy border town, no longer. The plea went out to the whole wide world. TV, CNN, and the AP News showed the horror and death. Newspapers and TV footage graphically depicted the scene. The United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees came in, along with many NGOs. People offered to extend a hand, a dollar, or themselves. A tragedy was underway, and help was late. But interest stirred. Oh, Goma, it's only just begun. The planes came in, some 30 a day. The airport was extended, and trucks and equipment rolled out. Sheeting, tarps, blankets, and food. Relief was arriving. Water pumps and tanker trucks came. But the town was overrun and buildings were trashed. The people had to move. There were just too many. There were just too many. Oh, Goma, you pretty little town. No longer. Camps were made. Mungunga, Katali, and Kimbumba. The people moved out of town to them, crammed into little shelters with tarps for cover. Thousands spotting the hills and fields, each camp with nearly 300,000 people. There, food and water came, and the deaths decreased. The hillsides grew more barren as trees were cut down for firewood. The sky filled with smoke from the thousands of fires. Oh, Goma, will you ever recover? The situation settled and some order established. Volunteers came and helped with the sick, the hungry, and the alone. Orphans were cared for and parents found. Unaccompanied children were fostered, and malnourished children were fed. The tragedy was getting under control. Cholera had run its course, and the world started to lose interest. Oh, Goma, what have you become? The volunteers came from all walks of life to help in some way. Living conditions were rough. They often slept in tents and bathed in cold water. And everywhere one turned, one saw an outstretched hand. Hands from refugees for food. Hands from local officials for bribery money. Many dollars were spent, with lots not making it to the refugees in need. Oh, Goma, corruption and extortion have overtaken you. The nights brought murders in the camps. Hutu soldiers killing civilians wanting to return to their homeland. Confrontations with Zaire and Rwandan soldiers led to innocent deaths. Gunshots in the night. The sick and malnourished continued to die. And every morning, the truck rolled through the camp, picking up the dead on the side of the road. Oh, Goma, you safe little town. No longer. Little children, dirty, hungry, sad, and alone. Most without mommy or daddy, or both. Many saw soldiers butcher their parents. Most barely made it out alive. No hot showers, hot meals, clean sheets, or clean clothes. No sign of family or friends. They may all be dead. Nobody to love them. No future. No dreams. No hope. only sorrow and death. Not just for now, but for generations. O Goma, you city of hope, no longer. Volcanic dust and dirt permeate the volunteer's eyes, ears, and nose. Black dirt everywhere. Stones are pulled from one's shoes and clothes are soiled. The sickness also hits the volunteers with colds, the flu, and worse. Most get bouts of diarrhea. Living is rough. Work is filled with sadness and grief. The air is full of odors and stench. O Goma, you healthy little town, no longer. The situation looks grim, as weeks have turned into months. While food and water are being provided to the people, the question of term continues to be asked. How much longer can Rwandans live like this, in tents, temporary, and away from home? How much longer can the Zairians tolerate them? How soon until Rwanda reconciles? Or will the people ever? O Goma, your future is certain, no longer. Volunteers come and go, each having given a piece of him or herself, a smile to a child, love to an orphan, food to the malnourished, medical help to the sick, and encouragement to all. Volunteers leave with mixed feelings, overwhelmed and frustrated, wishing they could have done more, yet glad to have helped, knowing they've seen hell firsthand. There are no regrets for going and investing in this crisis. O Goma, you will never be the same. O Rwanda, you will never be the same. Nor will I. Jeff Eales, September 1994.
I flew to London in the club class, and I thank my UN ID card for the upgrade. Then I had another 7 hours before my flight to the US. I asked the gate attendant if I could change my flight to be direct to LAX instead of having two stops en route. She didn't want to let me do it and said she'd charge me to change my ticket, even after I appealed to a supervisor. I finally played all my cards and said, "Ma'am, all I'm asking is to get home 5 hours sooner. I've been in the Rwanda refugee camps for nearly 3 weeks, sleeping in a tent and bathing out of a bucket, and seeing horror and misery every day. I've been traveling for 24 hours already. I'm tired, and all I want to do is go home." I then whipped out my UN volunteer ID card and laid it on the counter. She consulted again with the supervisor in the back office, and then she returned and said,
"We'll allow this flight change with no upcharge this time, just this once."
I responded, "Bless you, bless you." She was a tough lady. I took a shuttle van from LAX to the Orange County Airport and was picked up by my wife and father-in-law and got home after 40 hours of traveling. My wife and kids had made a huge welcome home sign and posted it on the garage door. It was great to take a hot shower and see my family, and it was really nice to sleep in a real bed. I did go to the office the next day. And then I typed up my poem I'd written at the Nairobi airport, and I think I only changed two or three words. That poem had poured out of me in about 20 minutes. They were words that captured this tired volunteer's thoughts and emotions who was reflecting on the magnitude of the genocide, refugees, and the entire experience. I was asked by quite a few groups to share about my trip, which I did, as the Rwanda refugee crisis was still prevalent in the news. I think I spoke to about 8 groups in a formal setting: Lions Club, Rotary Club, several church groups, my office staff, and a few others. I was interviewed by the local newspaper for an article. My company wrote an article about my trip for the newsletter. I also shared my photo album and my daily journal with probably 20 people as they wanted to read about it and see photos from someone that had actually been on the ground there. I even hosted an evening with friends answering questions, telling them stories, followed by watching the movie Hotel Rwanda. It really does a pretty good job of representing what happened. If you haven't watched the movie, you should. I remember looking at my children a bit differently upon my return. My kids got a warm bath every day and 3 meals a day and had loving parents raising them. I'd just left kids in our care that were orphans, unaccompanied, had probably seen their parents killed in front of them, and had suffered physical and emotional pain beyond what should be allowed. They didn't have warm beds, 3 meals a day, and a warm bath like my kids. I felt so sorry for those Rwandan children or their parents that had lost their children through the butchery, so I appreciated my blessings with my wife and children so much more. I hugged my family a little tighter after that. The refugees stayed in Zaire for about 2 years, and then, one day, almost en masse, they started to return. The Hutu soldiers couldn't stop them. So a mere 30,000 soldiers had controlled a million people through fear for about 2 years. Pretty incredible, if you think about it. It was just a few years later that a civil war broke out in Zaire, resulting in millions dying by bullets, machetes, or disease in the forest. I feared it would be deja vu all over again, just like Rwanda. In 1998, President Bill Clinton gave a speech basically apologizing for not acting quicker when the Rwanda genocide started. I kept that newspaper article, and then I wrote an article that was published on October 29, 2000 in the Orange County Register newspaper. It was Sunday edition, front page, top fold of the commentary section. In that article, I mentioned the similarities that were going on in Zaire right then and how the U.S., the UN, and the world hadn't taken any steps to stop it, just like in Rwanda. I could give my personal opinion on why the UN and the West allows atrocities like this to occur on the African continent, yet will jump in at the smallest other skirmish in other countries. But I'm sure you can draw your own conclusion and probably have your own theory on the double standard. I predicted then that it would take 2 to 3 generations for the Rwandan people to move past the genocide. Now, I can't believe how well the country has progressed. The world did an incredible outpouring of relief, money, time, and effort to restore the country's infrastructure and healing to the people. Overall, the country has rebounded, unified, rebuilt, and healed much more quickly than I imagined in September of 1994. And that is a good thing for sure. I am surprised at how quickly the restoration has been, and 30 years ago, I'd have bet that the country would remain in disarray for much longer than a generation or two. I'm glad I was wrong in my assessment. Forgiveness, healing, and restoration are powerful antidotes to a country divided by butchery and tribal hate. Financial aid, thousands of people, and considerable investment has gone into rebuilding the country, restoring hope and healing, and recreating the infrastructure. Churches, NGOs, and folks from all over the world extended time, materials, and support to help Rwanda. Churches have built and sponsored schools, clinics, hospitals, and other projects. And for that, I commend everyone for their contributions to help bring Rwanda back to a stable and prosperous country with a new identity and unity. Dr. Tom summarizes the entire Rwanda situation thusly.
The huge need for spiritual healing and restoration of relationships has been a big issue there in Rwanda ever since. They've had a lot of help. I wouldn't say that it's totally resolved in any way, though people are no longer allowed to identify themselves as one tribe or another. Their identity cards don't reflect that anymore. But this is human nature. This is sin. This is the sinful nature that people have. It just emphasizes all the more why we as a mission and why we as Christians need to be doing all we can to help, helping with healing in places like that in order to prevent episodes like that ever occurring again.
I also asked Thelma to share one memory that she will forever cherish and never forget.
At Christmas, the second time when I went back, the village where we were working, they invited me and Karen to come there for Christmas Day. And of course, you have a long African service for church, and we were trying to keep the kids from having to be sitting in church all day. So we organized a kids program where they did the Christmas story. And in the middle of a refugee situation, I don't know where they found the stuff that they used, but we had some very interesting costumes for our Christmas story. And we had a baby Jesus in a little round red plastic tub and a real baby with pink shoes, I remember. And we just had the whole church there for the kids doing their Christmas program, which was really, really fun. And then we all went to church, and at church, I can remember sitting there crying as people would get up and thank the Lord for the way he had helped them find a child or for something that had happened during their time. And then our meal consisted of, this was a special Christmas Day meal. Some Spanish group had killed some beef and brought meat around to each of the refugee areas where people were being cared for. And we had a little 1-inch square piece of beef that was probably as tough as you could imagine. But everybody got one little tiny piece of meat on a bowl of rice. And that was a special, special Christmas dinner that I will never forget.
A Christmas dinner with a single small bite of beef on a plate of rice in the middle of a refugee camp. A memory she'll never forget. What a neat story. I've helped organize and support a mountain bike charity event for 13 years, where $1.3 million were raised to support the National Rwanda Cycling Team that started from scratch and now has sent riders to the Olympics and professional European race teams. This creates national pride and unity. So besides working in the refugee camps in 1994, I've given in that way to the country. I look back and don't think I had much of an impact. I was one person, helping a team with a mere 175 unaccompanied or orphan kids out of a million people. How does that change anything? I'll never know how I impacted the ones I came in contact with in the refugee camps. But I was impacted, and many people I talked to upon my return were impacted as well. Regardless, I was one of the few who could go due to my background and language skills, and I did go. And I'm glad I went. It was a great experience that changed me for the better. I want to thank Thelma Landrude and Dr. Tom Cairns for sharing their experiences to complement my story of this event we all shared in. And a special thanks to Rick Saleen, retired Minneapolis radio personality, for reciting the poem I wrote while at the Nairobi, Kenya airport in September 1994. I hope this episode of my small part in the Rwanda genocide refugee camps helps you understand from my perspective what happened. One thing I'll never forget is the horror that happened in Rwanda. I know, since I was there. And I pray nothing like it ever happens again.
To the refugee camps I went. I gave a piece of myself. A smile to a child. Love to an orphan. Food to the malnourished, medical help to the sick, and encouragement to all. I left with mixed feelings, overwhelmed and frustrated, wishing I could have done more, yet glad to have helped, knowing I'd seen hell firsthand. There are no regrets for going and investing in this crisis. O Goma, you will never be the same. O Rwanda, you will never be the same. Nor will I.
So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eels, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninga nangai, tikala malamu. My friends, stay well.